Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Accumulating stuff is surprisingly easy. With the click of a button, you can order pretty much anything you want. Suddenly, you find yourself with a closet of clothes you don't wear or kitchen gadgets you never use. Or maybe you're storing boxes of things that haven't been opened since you last moved 20 years ago. For some people, the impulse to collect and keep things is difficult to control and begins to impact their mental and physical welfare. Others recognize they have too much stuff but don't know where or how to start the organizing process. Today, we talk about organizing and decluttering and signs that a tendency to collect may be unhealthy. Joining us in studio is Denise Egan-Stack. She's mental health consultant for the Cape Hoarding Task Force, board member of the International OCD Foundation, and an affiliate with the Massachusetts General Hospital's OCD Clinic. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
Also with us is Julie Brooks, member of the National Association of Professional Organizers and part of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
On the phone, Carol McDonald, who struggled with collecting and started a buried treasures support group in Provincetown. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, how are you, Mindy?
Great. Carol, can we start with you by maybe telling us about your experience collecting things and before you sought help?
Well, I started thinking back on my life. I started over-collecting back when I was about 12 years old. I had true romance magazines and movie magazines stacked in the closet as high as the closet was. I've had books, and I had records, and I definitely had too much. That went on. Books have always been something that I treasure, and still magazines and books and records, well, CDs now.
Yeah.
And I became aware that it was a problem when we moved several times.
So how long ago was it that you realized that you maybe needed some help with this?
Oh, probably. Every time the door bell rang, I would panic because somebody was going to come in and see the mess. Ah. So as long as I've really lived on my own, I think,
yeah.
So probably 45 years. I'm 82.
Denise, how common is hoarding?
Hoarding affects about 2-6% of the population, and data that we've gathered after running epidemiological studies show us that it's really universal, and there's a consistent clinical presentation for all races, ethnicities, cultures around the world.
Are the characteristics of a hoarder separate them from someone who just likes to collect things? There's a line, there's a difference,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Right. So a hoarding disorder is a mental health condition where people have difficulty getting rid of things that are no longer of use to them. I mean, in our lives, we all sort of go through times where we may have difficulty getting rid of things if we're downsizing a home or we're going through if someone has just passed away, a loved one passed away, and you're going through their possessions, it might be very difficult to get rid of things. But for people with hoarding disorder, it's difficult for them all the time. And this difficulty results in clutter that causes spaces to become unusable or almost unusable. So people who are, you know, they can't sleep in their beds, or they can't eat dinner at the kitchen table, or they can't shower in their shower because those living spaces are now unusable because of clutter, which is an accumulation of the things that people can't get rid of.
Now, Carol mentioned that she started this when she was about 12.
Mm-hmm.
Is it common for adult hoarders to have displayed collecting tendencies as children?
Yes. I think people are generally pretty surprised to hear that saving behavior does start in children as early as, you know, between 11 and 15. But hoarding gets more and more severe with each passing decade. So it's about around age in the 50s where people are coming into treatment. And I think it's probably because it's over at that particular period of time. It's like all of these things have been accumulated across the decades, and it's really started to cause distress and impairment in life functioning.
We want to hear from you. Have you had success decluttering, organizing, or downsizing? Was it hard as you imagined? What was your strategy? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Julie, if early signs of hoarding are a desire to collect and keep things, what are some of the warning signs that we should be aware of that might indicate we have a little bit of a problem?
Well, Denise has shared what, you know, the clinical definition of hoarding would be. As a professional organizer, I don't really concentrate on labels or whether somebody's a hoarder or not. Most people who call me say that their sister-in-law says they're a hoarder. But generally, most of the people that we work with maybe eventually they would be hoarders, but the reason they are calling me, the reason they're in distress is because every time they open their closet to get dressed in the morning, it gives them an anxiety attack because it's so out of control and disorganized. They have trouble finding things. They waste a lot of time trying to find things. They are at the point, maybe almost where Carol was, where they're ashamed for people to come over to their house, or it takes 2 days of a massive cleaning, you know, binge to actually have people over for a dinner party. Not being able to pay bills on time because there's so much paperwork scattered all over the place that's not organized. So even if somebody isn't a quote-unquote hoarder, being disorganized and having too much clutter can definitely negatively impact their life.
Yeah. It wasn't long ago that people who hoarded items were looked at as lazy or unclean. But we know that hoarding is a behavioral health disorder, Denise, as you were saying, and until recently was seen as part of obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm-hmm. So is that still the case?
The stigma associated with hoarding disorder? Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think that shows like Hoarders haven't really done people with hoarding disorder any sort of service. It's a reality TV show that's meant for, it dramatizes hoarding disorder. And I think that not all people with hoarding disorder have that a severe of a case. So I think shows like that have really hurt the cause. But shows like this, I think, are helpful. I think you're educating people about the fact that it is a mental health condition, not a moral issue. And, you know, as we go on through the program, we'll talk a little bit about the clinical features and also what treatment options there are, which oftentimes include professional organizers as part of the team.
Yeah. Carol, is there a stigma that goes along with hoarding? You mentioned that you were kind of reluctant to, you know, when people would come, every time that doorbell would ring. Was the stigma part of what you were worried about?
No, not really. I'm not really that bad. Right now, the beautiful dining room table that I got is kind of covered with everything that's piled on it. That's a problem. That's an embarrassment. But I'm very, I have a lot of stuff because I have quite a few animals. Mm-hmm. I'm a gardener. As I said, books and magazines are my problem. And organization and finding places to put things has been a problem. But I don't feel any stigma. Nobody on the outside would ever know that I'm very untidy.
I was gonna, and Denise, that's common, right? You can't just look at somebody walking down the street and go, "Yep, they're a hoarder." I mean, they just look like everybody else, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, many of the people on my caseload are intelligent, creative, fun, funny. Mm-hmm. You're not just see someone walking down the street and say, they're a hoarder, you know. But I do think there are many people with hoarding disorder who do have shame. So they, if they don't have low insight, if they have, mm-hmm. you know, if they have insight into the problem, they have shame. They don't want people to come to the door and report them to the health officials. They have difficulty having people over because there's no place to sit, or, you know, they're not cooking in their kitchen. So I do think for many people, it does cause problems in relationships.
And then there are also hoarders who don't realize they have a problem, right? They think this is perfectly fine.
Exactly. In the DSM-5, which, you know, it's our diagnostic and statistical clinical manual for diagnosing people with mental health conditions, you have to meet certain criteria to be considered, you know, someone with hoarding disorder. And then there's also these specifiers, and one of them is what level of insight you have, because if people have low insight, it makes it more difficult to treat.
Yeah. Julie, do you get that sometimes where somebody goes, "Hey, my sister-in-law is a hoarder. I want to go help her declutter." And maybe the person you're wanting to help declutter doesn't want that help.
Yes, I frequently get calls like that. People will call. Usually it's about their parents. And I say, "Has your mother expressed interest in decluttering? Or has she expressed interest in getting some outside help?" And if the person hasn't expressed interest, if they live in a house that's, you know, maybe I would consider it cluttered, maybe you would consider it cluttered, but it's not hoarding, they're happy with it, it doesn't look that great, then they're happy. There's nothing. There's nothing we can do, nor should I, really. I mean, if they're happy living in it and they seem to be living a relatively functional, healthy life, so be it.
I think it gets a little bit more complicated when someone's not living a healthy and functioning life. I think that's the difference between hoarding disorder and people who are just savers, right? Mm-hmm. But even so, if the parent is not expressing interest it really does, it sort of shuts down the whole process. I think one thing that I like to point out in these programs is that well-meaning family members oftentimes want to go in and clean out for
Don't
a person.
Do it.
The person
Don't
goes
do
on
it.
Vacation,
yeah.
the person's, nope. you know, in the hospital for a couple of days, people say, we're going to go in and clean it out. And that is experienced as a trauma. And people, in some cases, it's resulted in people committing suicide. So it is, it may be well intended, but it has really awful consequences.
Yeah. And some hoarders have described really strong connections to items, sometimes with little or no apparent value. You know, it could be pieces of paper, right? I mean, there are things that we go, why would you save this?
Mm-hmm.
But to them, there's a connection, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people save for several different reasons. I mean, one of them is that something has value, like there's instrumental value. Like, you know, if I can find, I could use this for this. Or, you know, if I can think of a use for it, then it becomes my responsibility to keep it, to use it for that reason. Or that fan is broken, but I know how to fix it. And so therefore, I'm going to keep it to fix it, but they never get to fix it. Mm-hmm. Other times, people keep things for sentimental reasons, right? Like, this is my, these are my son's booties from when they were younger. That maybe, but then every single item of clothing that they've had between, you know, ages 2 and 7 probably shouldn't make the cut, right?
Right.
And then they're also keeping reasons, like keeping for intrinsic reasons, like this color blue is so beautiful to me, or I look so beautiful in this color blue, or I like the painting on the wall that's color blue. Anything with that color blue is now kept.
Mm. Carol, talk a little bit about, you mentioned you had all these albums and books and magazines. How did you go about deciding which ones to keep and which ones to get rid of?
I kept everything.
You did.
The printed word has extreme value to me. I just ordered on Kindle the complete works of Jane Austen and the complete works of Charles Dickens. Now, am I going to throw away my hard copies of those? Probably not. It's very hard for me. I always think I'm going to read everything. I'm going to cut out pieces that I might want to keep. It's so silly. I don't need to be keeping these things because everything is available online. But they have value to me. Somebody worked hard to write these things, even the magazine articles. Mm-hmm. I'm much better than I used to be. The Buried in Treasures self-help group has just... I'm going to our end of season, fifth year of the self-help group in Provincetown and potluck supper this evening.
Yeah.
And I am vastly improved.
All right. When you say vastly improved, how have you improved? You just keep less or you've gotten rid of some? Or how did you improve? Order less?
Unfortunately, Amazon has been very difficult for me. I do order a lot of stuff, which means I have always cardboard boxes sitting around. We try to not acquire it. I would never stop and pick up free porch chairs on the mm-hmm. side of the street. We don't acquire anymore. We don't buy anything. When you go to a self-help group, you ask yourself, do I need this? Do I have a place for it? Do I already have this? Am I going to use it within a year? You have various set of questions you ask yourself before you acquire something. And that has been very helpful to me.
Yeah. And Carol,
unfortunately, I still order many too many magazines.
And Carol, you started Buried Treasures Group, right, in Provincetown? Did you?
No.
You're a member.
I was in Denise's inaugural.
I started it.
Oh, you
yeah.
started it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Five years ago.
All right. Tell us what this group is.
Sure. So Buried in Treasures, I call it like a therapeutic book club. So everyone in the group reads a book called Buried in Treasures, and it is a very user-friendly book that breaks down information about what hoarding is, how it develops, and what to do about it. So it's really teaching people a set of skills about how to organize their possessions, how to make decisions, how to reduce avoidance. And it's run all across the world, actually. And the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we wrote a grant so that we could bring it to the Cape. And we had groups that run Barnstable, Yarmouth, Falmouth, Provincetown. So I started the one in Provincetown, and Carol was one of my members.
And Carol, you follow a group called Finders Keepers. What's that?
Well, after our, for instance, when we have our final session of Buried in Treasures, you have a choice of continuing finders keepers, which if for those people who have been in the Buried in Treasures group that have an interest in keeping up. Mm. We all set goals. We report in at the end of a week or how often we have the meeting. We report whether we succeeded at our goals. And it's been very helpful. For instance, I said last week my goal was to clean the space around my chair where I have books and magazines and everything else piled up. Just that kind of stuff. Mm. And it's clear now. I took a picture before, taking a picture after, and I will show it to the group. So those of us, some of us really like groups. It's always a very friendly, welcoming group. And some of us really like groups, which this is the way I feel about the Buried in Treasures group. And we want to continue it off-season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing is that the Buried in Treasures group is time-limited, you know, 15 to 20 weeks, depending upon how you're running it. But really what we know about treatment is that it should be continuing on, right? That we need to be consistent across time. And the group that Carol's discussing, you know, the formal Buried in Treasures group might end, but the group members can get together and carry it on. Right. And they can be a therapeutic community for each other, but also hold each other accountable.
Yeah. I'll say, it sounds like the goal setting is very realistic. Carol's saying her goal is not to clean everything out. It's just, her goal is just to clean around her chair.
But that is a skill that we teach in Buried in Treasures group, because many people with hoarding disorder are perfectionistic. Mm-hmm. And so it's like they need, it's all or nothing, right? Mm. So I'm going to clean off my kitchen table and I'm never going to clutter it back up. And really a more reasonable goal would be to say, you know, 30 minutes every day, spend time sorting and discarding, again, based on rules that we teach in the Buried in Treasures group.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us your story. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about organizing and decluttering and signs that a tendency to collect may be unhealthy. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Denise Egan-Stack, mental health consultant for the Cape Hoarding Task Force, board member at the International OCD Foundation, and an affiliate with Mass General Hospital's OCD Clinic. Also with us is Julie Brooks, member of the National Association of Professional Organizers and part of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. And on the phone, Carol McDonald, who struggled with collecting and is part of the Buried Treasure Support Group in Provincetown. All right, so hoarding can be a physical safety issue. We talked about table. You know, you could have them in your shower. Sometimes you can't move through the house. Julie, so you come across those clients sometimes,
mm-hmm.
right? And
yep.
And that can be a difficult thing, right? Because mm-hmm. that's a lot of stuff to go through.
And right.
And maybe we can talk with Denise about mm-hmm. why they don't want to. But how do you tackle something that big?
Well, I find that even if someone isn't a quote-unquote hoarder, right, they, like the example I gave before, their closet is overwhelming, their basement, like they're trying to put their house on the market, they're trying to downsize, they're trying to get to the next phase in their life, but they're stuck because what am I going to do with all the stuff in this basement? What am I going to do with it all? Where is it all going to go, right? So in the professional organizing profession, we say that clutter is delayed decisions, right? And we all have delayed decisions. I probably have some in my purse right now, right? So it just means that we couldn't decide what to do with something. So we decided not to decide. And we put it in what we call a stash and dash room, which would be a guest room, a basement, a garage, somewhere, the kitchen junk drawer, somewhere where you don't have to decide where things go. Why do we avoid deciding about things? Guilt. Thinking that an exaggerated sense of responsibility about things, thinking that we have to find the perfect resting place for every single thing in our house. We have to find the perfect recipient for every book that we don't want anymore. Part of our job as pro organizers is to simplify and streamline the process. Often people's thinking gets in the way of simplification of the whole process. I mean, you don't even have to talk to a professional organizer to know, just Google it, to declutter a room. You put everything into keep, donate, and toss, three different boxes, right? well, that's easy. So how come we're even having this program today?
Yeah.
Because people
not
find
so
that
easy. Yeah.
It's not so easy. People find that very hard. Often there are emotions associated with even things that you wouldn't think would be emotional. Not just grandma's vase or the prom dress you wore in the 80s, but certain things like an old driver's license or just all kinds of things have a lot of emotions packed into them. And many people avoid emotions.
Mm-hmm.
The clutter builds up and up and up, and then eventually, you know, people are listening to this program.
All right, Denise, avoidance. That's what it's about, right?
Exactly. So, as a clinician, I have a little bit more of a clinical spin on it, mm-hmm. right? But there are emotional risk factors associated with hoarding disorder, and one of them is called anxiety sensitivity. And so that is when people fear anything that's going to cause them anxious feelings. Or people may have what we call distress intolerance, so an inability to tolerate discomfort. And so that is when you see avoidance, right? So if people have a very hard time, they fear anxiety, or they have a very hard time tolerating discomfort, then you could see how that would result in indecision. If there's a fear of making a mistake and they confront, do I throw this away? They are triggered. What if I make a mistake? What if I need it another time? Does this mean I'm irresponsible? I don't want to fill a landfill and be part of the problem. That'll cause distress. And if someone has an inability to tolerate that, they will avoid that situation. They'll say, oh, forget it. I'll do that later. Mm-hmm. Right? Because then that brings their distress level down and then they can feel more comfortable. Again, you know, if that is the way that you make decisions or don't make decisions, that all of those instances accumulate. Right. I forgot the room that you used, the term that you used,
stash
Julie,
room.
But stash room. Exactly. Yeah. All of these things accumulate, and that the clutter piles are just the accumulation of avoidance.
Well, also, even beyond that, you're avoiding this. And then it comes to a point you have so much stuff that it's overwhelming. Right. I mean,
right.
just to look, you go, oh, my gosh, where do I even begin in this? You know,
I often say that our clients are stuck in overwhelm.
Mm hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things we teach in Buried in Treasures is where to get started, how to get started. And many people avoid it because they're so anxious, but then they really never learn that if they can get through that initial part of discomfort and then they're actually being productive and then they're going to feel so much better afterwards. They sort of get stuck in the beginning part of the process, mm-hmm. and the group really helps people get past that first initial avoidance into the actual work, which is doable, less anxious than they thought, mm-hmm. less difficult than they thought it would be, less anxious than they thought they would be. And at the end, they feel so much better than they ever thought they would. That's what we're trying to do. That's a new frame of reference.
Carol, does that describe your experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything has gotten better over the 5 years that I've been in this maintenance class, basically, you'd call it. It's so much easier. For instance, when I decide to clean that tidy up around my chair, which is difficult because I usually have a cat sitting on my lap, but I have to throw the cat off. I filled up a large garbage bag of magazines to take to the recycling. I'm not going to read these. What I can find all these recipes and home decorating and gardening things all online. I don't need to keep these. So I have three bags going to the recycling bin this afternoon. It really does get so much easier. Our house is really not bad now, though I say that it is.
Yeah.
I'm not embarrassed anymore for somebody to come to the house. And that's taken 5 years.
Yeah. But if someone is stuck in avoidance, they never get that frame of reference that it is easier than they thought it would be. The anxiety does not last as long as they think it will. And at the end, it feels so much better than they ever thought it would. Mm-hmm. Once you can get that going, it can become a self-reinforcing process where, you know, I know it'll kind of be hard in the beginning, but it'll get better after 15 minutes and I'll feel great at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's very powerful.
I tell clients that have anxiety about the entire process of organizing. Anxiety is a feeling. Feelings are like the weather. They pass. They don't last forever.
Yeah. Let's talk to Janet, who's calling us from Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I have two things to tell you. I'm not a hoarder, but I've lived in this house for 38 years, and I'm planning on moving in a couple of years. And I looked around, and I saw these things in my garden shed. So I've had two truckloads of stuff taken away.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, my house is clean. I clean every day. You know, I'm maniacal about that. but it made it harder to clean and took more time. And it was a wonderful feeling. Some friends helped me, and we just got rid of a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Great.
So, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about, which really disturbs me, is I hear these stories about animal hoarders.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the reasoning behind them doing that?
Yeah. We actually, Janet, thank you for the phone call. That is, some people don't collect just objects. Denise, as you know, they collect animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. We have had cases of that here on the Cape and Islands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that really what happens is that people don't quite understand that they don't have the ability to care for this large number of animals. I mean, you know, they're caring, they care about them, but they just don't have the capacity to care for them, and they have low insight about that.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say insight's probably a big,
very low.
A big thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Do you come across that, Julie, in your work, animals?
No.
It's more stuff. Janet, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Janet brought up a good point, though. She's obviously not a hoarder, but she's lived in this house for 38 mm-hmm. years. And amazing. I've lived in my house for 20, and I go down in the basement sometimes. And I go, why do I have that? Right? I mean, you just sort of forget. You put mm-hmm. things, as you say, in that basement or garage or, you know, stash room, as you call it, and you kind of forget they're there.
Right.
And
right.
And if you've got boxes that you haven't unpacked from the last time you moved in,
right.
It was, you know, 10, 20 years ago. You probably don't need that box, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on what's in the box. We don't really need photos either our family, right? So usually the reason why a box hasn't been unpacked is because it's got emotional things in it, right? It's just the end product of avoidance. But somebody like the caller, that's a perfect example of somebody who, you know, that the kind of clients that we work with, usually there's a touch point, an event that's going to happen. They need to downsize and go to assisted living. They need to put their house on the market. And that forces them to deal with all the items that are in their stash rooms, right? And often, as we talked about before, they're packed with emotion, so people have been avoiding it all this time. And what we do is ask people to approach the items with a need it, use it, love it. So those mm-hmm. three questions. Do I need it? Do I use it? Do I love it?
Marie Kondo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Or when it comes to particularly clothes, a great question to ask is, if I saw this in a store today, would I buy it again?
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one. That's a really tough question because almost always we know what the answer is. No.
Yeah. And also, I'm going to buy this. I know it's two sizes smaller because I'm going to lose some weight and I'm going to fit in this dress in a year, right?
That's called aspirational clutter. That's also buying all the yarn for the crochet projects we're going to do once we retire and we have all this time and all that, right?
Yeah. So I think there's three categories of people. I think our caller is like one category where she understood that there was a problem. She can take action on her own and she feels great doing it. Another category is, you know, people who have too much stuff. They don't qualify as hoarding disorder, they have difficulty organizing their possessions, making decisions, categorizing things. They'll call in someone like Julie who will teach them, and they're mm-hmm. excited to learn. And then they practice that with Julie's support, and then things move on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm representing more of a clinical sample mm-hmm. where people really have brain. There's differences in their brain. Hoarding disorder mm-hmm. versus us who don't have hoarding disorder. There's genetic factors. There are emotional risk factors that make this incredibly difficult, and it's more of a therapeutic, a treatment
thing. Now, is there evidence that hoarding has a genetic component?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
So if you have hoarders in your family, that's something we've got. What are some of the other risk factors?
So we talked about them already. Some of them are the emotional risk factor. So again, genetic is hoarding runs in families. If you have a first degree relative who has hoarding, you are more likely to have hoarding. The emotional risk factors are, like I said, anxiety sensitivity, intolerance of distress, intolerance of uncertainty, impulse control, difficulty, self-control difficulty. Those are the emotional risk factors. And then there's this interesting thing. People with hoarding disorder generally have experienced many more traumatic life events than people without hoarding
mm-hmm.
disorder. And we are not quite sure what that actually means, but there's some evidence that ties the severity of hoarding disorder to the number mm-hmm. of traumatic life events. And there's also some evidence linking the onset of hoarding disorder with a traumatic life event.
So how is hoarding treated? And we mentioned support groups, but it's more than support groups, mm-hmm. right?
So hoarding disorder is treated primarily through cognitive behavioral therapy, where we're targeting people's thought processes, that you know their sentimental attachments. We're targeting their anxiety sensitivity, their distress intolerance. We're teaching them actual organizational skills. And that can happen individually, that can happen in a therapeutic group, or that can happen in a group like Buried in Treasures.
And how often is it successful?
You know, so there's anecdotal and then mm-hmm. there's the treatment studies. I mean, the treatment studies do show that people can get significantly better in cognitive behavioral therapy. But people really do have to be motivated, and treatment can oftentimes take a long time. Mm-hmm. And there are not as many trained professionals as we need. So mm-hmm. on the Cape, there's maybe one or two. Mm-hmm. And so we're really relying on the Buried in Treasures groups and people like Julie, the organizers, to mm-hmm. help people.
Yeah. Carol, you kind of mentioned this ongoing effort. You know, after the Buried Treasures, you got the Finders Keepers, and you like that support of the support group. How else do you keep your collecting impulses under control? Is it pretty much through the support groups?
No, because I continued it. The Finders Keepers thing is kind of new for me. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to control our acquiring. Mm-hmm. But also, one of the suggestions that we got from Buried in Treasures was if you're tempted to buy something online, put it in your shopping cart and don't buy it that day. Yep. And chances are you're going to forget about it and you don't really need it when you go back on the next day. That's just one of the suggestions that we got from somebody in the group, and it's worked very well for me.
That's a great suggestion, that kind of impulse, right? Your impulsivity.
I do that.
By the next time you go on, you've forgotten all about it and you don't care anymore.
Yeah, right. All right, Carol, let's talk to Gwendolyn, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Gwendolyn.
Hi. I'm calling with a book that my sister recommended. It's called Lightly by Francine Jay. You know of it?
No. Do you know it?
No.
It's on the same topic that you're talking about. So it's about living lighter in terms of your possessions, your emotions. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed the book, and I actually listened to it on Audible. Mm-hmm. And then I bought a hard copy, and I shared it with some of my book club friends.
Okay,
and I just think it's a title you want to explore, Lightly by Francine J.
Lightly by, I'm sorry, say the author again.
Francine. Well, let me make sure I'm giving it to you. It's J-A-Y, Francine J. How to Live a Simple, Serene, and Stress-Free Life. And the Audible version is so lovely to listen to. I had it in my car.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Gwendolyn. Thanks for calling. We appreciate that. Let's talk about that. Yeah, thank you. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about organizing and decluttering and signs that a tendency to collect may be unhealthy and hoarding. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Denise Egan-Stack, mental health consultant for the Cape Hoarding Task Force, board member at the International OCD Foundation, and an affiliate with Mass General Hospital's OCD Clinic. Julie Brooks is a member of the National Association of Professional Organizers and part of the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. And Carol McDonald has struggled with collecting, and she is a member of the Buried Treasures Support Group. Again, 866-999-4626 is our number, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Denise, one of the things that you do with folks is you take them on shopping trips. And this is not so much to buy a bunch of stuff, though, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us what the strategy is there.
Sure. When you're diagnosing someone with hoarding disorder, you want to determine if they have something called, you know, with excessive acquiring or not. And excessive acquiring is when people are online shopping or going to, you know, the swap shops at their local dump or the church fairs you know, stopping on the side of the road and picking up whatever people are discarding for free. And so the inflow into the house is huge, right? Mm-hmm. And so doesn't matter how much you are getting rid of, how much you're moving on. If the inflow is greater than the outflow, then you have too much stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we have people do is, you know, we have people go on these, we call them like a shopping trip, and they'll go into, say, Ocean State Job Lot, and they'll go around and they'll put, you know, feel the urge to take those sheets or feel the urge to get three of those things because they're on sale and resist it and just walk around, feel the feelings. Remember, we talked about distress intolerance. People have difficulty experiencing uncomfortable emotions, so they will avoid that. They would avoid it by taking all those things, buying them, and taking them home, and then they have more, you know, more things in their house. We have them go around with their shopping cart, feel the feelings, and then leave them there. And now they have started to practice feeling feelings and not having to give in with them.
Very empowering, I would think, huh?
Yeah. And the other thing that sometimes people are shopping as acquiring as a social life, they're like, well, everyone at the swap shop, they're my friends. Or I have nothing else to do. Like, this is how I spend my time. This is how I bring joy into my life. And so, you know, an alternative strategy there is to teach people how to build their lives in other ways.
What are some first steps you recommend for people who might be concerned about the parents or other loved ones who might have issues with hoarding? We talked about don't go in and clean up their. So what are the first steps? What should you do?
Well, I think it depends on, I mean, with my clients, I always, we always start off with, let's define the problem, okay? So if somebody can educate themselves on what hoarding disorder is, like, is there a dangerous lack of mobility in a house because of clutter? Well, then you have a problem. If the house is just way more cluttered than you would like to live in, is that really a problem? I mean, sure, eventually when your parents pass on or go to assisted living, it's going to be an issue for you to deal with, but you're going to have to deal with it sooner or later anyway. So do you want to really jeopardize the relationship with your parents because their house drives you nuts when you're in it, but they're happy and it's not really an issue for their health or safety? So I tend to, you know, think let's just not have that conversation. If they're happy like that, then you know, don't worry about it.
All right, Denise, it's really a hoarding situation.
It's really
we've got you can't move through the house. You can't sleep in a bed. I mean, it's a dangerous
situation.
It's
a crisis. Yeah, exactly. So when I have these people calling me, one thing I really do recommend is that they get this Buried in Treasures group and read it, because they will now become educated about what the problem is and what we can do about it. Because if you're going to approach your family member, you know, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. There's an effective way and an ineffective way to do it. A lot of times, you know, adult children of, you know, older people who may have hoarding will come in angry. There's a high expressed emotion. Well, what we know about high expressed emotion is it shuts people down. It is not effective. What language do you want to use? Are you eye rolling or not? No, obviously you shouldn't. You know, like, this is a mess. Why are you doing this? How could you do this to us? We don't want that. There's language to use, body language to use, information to use that are going to increase the likelihood that you'll at least have an effective conversation about the problem, where you are not judging and you're offering support. And there are more effective ways of being supportive. If your parent invites you into the house to help them, you should not take over. You should not judge decision making. You should not move too quickly. You should do one thing at a time. You should stay focused and organized. And this book will really help people figure out what the effective strategies are.
I think last time we were talking about somebody who had a problem with books, and it was not having, and maybe not remembering the story completely, but it was something about letting that person, the hoarder, decide which books are going and which ones we're keeping. So it's not like we're getting rid of all of these books. It's the person who's the hoarder has to be part of the decision process.
Exactly. So if you are a family member and you're trying to help someone with this problem, you would say to them, how can I help you? Versus here's how I'm going to help you. You do not want to take control of the situation. You really want to empower them. And in my experience clinically, it may be in the first few sessions, I'm simply sitting there as support. But if the trust will build over time, if I take it at their pace and I take their lead, then over the course of time, they're asking me more for my opinion, or they're taking more support from me, or they'll let me lead things in a different way because I have allowed the time and the trust to build.
Yes, a big non-judgmental. That's key.
Of course. Yeah. And again, if you are understanding this is a mental health condition, it's more likely that you will look at it in a non-judgmental way.
All right, let's talk to Roger, who's calling from Chatham. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I wanted to introduce something else about the conversation I hadn't heard. My wife had a hoarding problem. She was an artist, and I've noticed that in the art world, there seems to be a lot of this kind of a situation where you see studios that are cluttered, you know, with massive amounts of items. In her case, she was a florist and an arts and crafts person. And anything she saw, she could imagine doing something with it, into turning it into a project, doing it in a class with kids or adults and so on. And so I've always associated with hoarding, in a sense, with artists and seeing possibilities with things.
Yeah.
And we had an awful time when we sold our house.
Yeah, Roger, thanks for sharing. And I think she's talking about that whole creative mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
yep.
see, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can take that rock and paint it. And before you know it, you've got all kinds of things.
You know what? That's why I say disorganized people are the most interesting people in the world. That's why I love my job. They have a lot of interests. They see beauty in places other people don't see beauty. And I would say a disproportionately large share of my client base are creative people,
yeah.
not just artists, but also musicians, writers, things like that. And they also tend to have difficulty sorting.
Mm-hmm.
Often people with that mindset. And as Denise knows, you have to sort before you can make decluttering decisions.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree with Roger. I mean, there's also science teachers who can see a science project
right.
in yep. anything.
Mm-hmm. And so create the creative mind.
Exactly.
And not just
exactly.
artists.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. All right. Mary writes, I have a question for Julie. I'm thinking of hiring an organizer. Are they going to make me throw out all my stuff?
That's the most common question we get. No, professional organizers, my team of people that work with me, we don't really, frankly, care how much stuff you decide to let go. That's not really any of my business. We are there to facilitate decisions. So, say, for example, if we're doing a closet, we can't know how many hoodie sweatshirts that you'd like to keep until we put all the hoodie sweatshirts all in one pile. And then we ask you things like, which are your favorites? Which ones of these have you not worn in a while? We apply the same structure to any, whether you're organizing a garage or a basement. So mm-hmm. it's absolutely no pressure to let things go whatsoever. But it helps when people are facilitating the decisions like we do. It helps you because you're saying, all right, this is the time I've devoted to reduce my possessions. I need to make the decision now. I'm not going to avoid it anymore.
Yeah. You said something before we went on the air that I want to bring up, and that is we're looking at this as a negative. We got to get rid of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, when you're organizing, you sometimes come across treasures you didn't remember that
right.
you have.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, this fantastic blouse that's been buried in the back of your closet, and you bought three other ones to try to replace it, but they weren't as good. We use terms that are more positive, like curating. We're going to keep the best of the best. We're going to keep things and find a place of honor for them in your home. We're going to let things go. We're going to donate. We're going to give things away. We're going to let this item go bless someone else. Because terms, as Denise can say, terms like throw away, get rid of, purge, it creates anxiety, not just in people with hoarding disorder, but people who have too many things just have anxiety about letting go of things. So we like to make that process as easy as possible.
Yeah.
I just think that, again, people often think like Julie or I are going to go into the house and take over and make people do anything. And that's actually not the truth. We're empowering people by teaching them a set of skills, providing some structure and support to help them move things on that are no longer useful so they can enjoy the things that they do want to keep that are useful.
Yeah, Lee writes, fascinating program. I had a friend who was a hoarder. He had tall columns of stuff everywhere, books, magazines, boxes, etc., which weren't glued together and never tumbled down, which was amazing. He told me that they comforted him. The floors were covered with magazines and paper. His stove wasn't functional since it was stacked high with stuff. When he died, I helped clean out his home, and he had 56 belts, 7 teapots, 5 dozen t-shirts. She goes on and on a list of some things. She said hoarders come in many ways. It's
mm-hmm.
true, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the things we're talking about is we talked about sort of family heirlooms. And, you know, people come across this stuff and they go, I can't get rid of that. That was, you know, this
mm-hmm.
grandmother, that aunt. And you could have a lot of family heirlooms. And some people feel this responsibility to find, as you were saying before, the right person to give that
mm-hmm.
to. And I think we're finding, especially the younger generation now, they don't want that family china or those, you know, wine goblets or what have you. Do you find that people have more difficulty parting with those types of things? And how do you convince them that maybe the thrift shop is the best place for those?
Well, yes, they do. Because anything that has family significance obviously has an emotional component to it. So I tell people, what if we could find, what if the person who really wants this particular set of dishes because it exactly matches the color in their room, if they were here right now, would you be happy to give them the dishes? They'd say, of course. I'd say, well, that's why we take them to a thrift store, because the perfect person will buy it there. You just won't know who it is. So it's a matter of giving people the confidence to know that they don't have to have complete and total control over the final recipient of every object in their house. I mean, you can find, you know, relatives to give five things away to and go through the emails and the delays and the phone calls and the putting off and the hemming and the hawing for five things. But if you have 500 things that you need to make decisions on, that's not going to be practical. Yeah. So it's always better to just streamline things and take donations to one place, right, at the end of the decluttering process. So the other thing I tell people is that you can also just curate. I have clients, they've got six sets of china because it's from their wife and her two parents, mm-hmm. and especially only children are the ones that have a lot of things, right? And so a tip that I give people is, why not keep one play setting from each set, right? And then when you have a family, a dinner, and it gives people the opportunity to talk about the different, oh, that was from Aunt Molly, mm-hmm. and this was from Uncle Jack, whereas normally they would have just been locked away in a closet somewhere and never would have been talked about.
Yeah.
But with hoarding disorder, we really need to get to this exaggerated sense of responsibility.
Yes.
So
yes.
If someone has passed away, your mother's passed away and left you her things, there's this, for people with hoarding disorder, for everybody, there's like, oh, this is my mom's stuff, I don't want to get rid of it. But for people with hoarding disorder, there really is an underlying exaggerated sense of responsibility we need to treat. Mm-hmm. Also, as I mentioned before, people with hoarding disorder tend to be perfectionists. And so they want the right place, the right person to get these particular things that they're willing to get rid of. And that really does slow down the process, because the right cousin that you see every other year, maybe, if we're waiting for that opportunity to move on this particular piece, it's really slowing down the outflow. So we have to get to those clinical issues.
Yeah. Carol, we only just have about a minute and a half left. Anything you want to add that you'd like people to know?
If they have a chance to get to a Buried in Treasures group, do it. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely fabulous. Denise, the one Denise started in Provincetown, got me started on me and my wife on this long, so far, 5 years of work, of hard work and maintaining. And Denise always said, just do it. Mm-hmm. Just write three lines, just pick up three things, set your kitchen timer for 5 minutes, and work for 5 minutes. And if you find you can do it longer, the next time set it for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Buried in Treasures really has been a very enjoyable, helpful group to belong to.
Yeah. And Marie Kondo, we mentioned she was a sensation for a while. Her mm-hmm. tactic was to touch every item and ask yourself if it gives you joy, mm-hmm. and then to say thank you and goodbye to mm-hmm. items. And mm-hmm. I think this is resonating with a lot of people.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We'll have links with more information about the Buried in Treasures and Clutterers Anonymous meetings, along with information about the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force at our website, capeandislands.org. Denise Agenstack, Julie Brooks, and Carol McDonald, thank you all so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.